This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. And we are doing a program on workers' compensation law, current issues, medical and disability benefit problems facing workers in California. This will be the first program where we're going to talk about a number of issues, but there is so much to talk about that we will do a second program, at which time one of my guests, Rob Wyman, will be the guest host. His guest will be Jason Marcus, who's going to be on the program with both Rob and me now. But so what I want you to do, if you have questions in the area of workers' comp, I want you to understand and feel comfortable with, we're doing Workers' Comp 1 tonight, and we're doing this program live on Wednesday, August 9th. And then we will do Workers' Comp 2, which will be on Wednesday, September 6th. And it turns out the reason I will not be hosting on September 6th is because it's my wife's and my anniversary. And I'm sure you can feel that I don't want to get in trouble. Okay. All right. For those of you who are listening to the live program, which we will take calls in about half an hour, you might want to jot down the toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. My guests are Jason Marcus, President-elect of California Applicants Attorneys Association, also referred to as CAW. And that website you might want to jot down, and we'll mention it again during the program, is CAAA@CAAA.org, CAAA@CAAA.org. He's a partner in the Sacramento law firm of Marcus, Regalado, and Marcus. My other guest is Rob Wyman. He goes by officially Robert Wyman, of course, but I'll call him Rob here. He's a member of CAAA. His office is in San Francisco, and both of my guests are specialists in workers' compensation law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies specialty in 11 fields of law. The California Applicants Attorneys Association, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and also by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which certifies four fields in the area of specialty. And I want to welcome both of you to the program. Great to have you back. And let me throw this at you, Rob, if you don't mind. What if I get hurt at work? What do I do? What do I have to do? And frankly, I think one of the things that I would be concerned about is, if I get hurt at work and complain or file a claim with my employer, am I apt to get fired?
There are discrimination laws that prevent a worker from being fired solely because they pursued a workers' compensation claim. So workers should feel safe pursuing claims. And by the way, Chuck, thank you for having me on tonight. It's always a pleasure to be here. And
it's great to have you here.
I look forward to chatting with my friend Jason.
Yep. Hey, hey.
The most important thing for a worker to do is notify somebody in management that they've had an injury.
Do you want to do it in writing, or does it make a difference?
It starts out just by telling someone orally that they've had an injury. The employer then has a duty to provide them with a document called a claim form.
Uh-huh.
And the worker can ask, may I have a claim form? It should be given to them.
Mm-hmm.
But they should feel free to ask, I need a claim form. Filling out that form, and it's a very simple form. The employee fills out the top half. The employer fills out the bottom half. It's sent off to the workers' compensation insurance company. And that starts the whole process rolling.
Mm.
Nothing happens until that's done. And simply telling a coworker is generally not enough. You need to speak to someone in management, a supervisor.
Okay. All right. Jason, let me throw this one at you. How important is it today, and what are the statistics on this? We discussed this before we went on the air, but I think it's very important. How important is it today for a worker to pre-designate with his employer who his doctor is, assuming he has some kind of relationship with the doctor?
Yeah, well, Chuck, as Rob said, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks for having me. What you're asking about is an important thing for folks who have not been hurt yet, and let's hope that they don't get hurt. But if they do get hurt, It would be in their best interest if they had pre-designated a doctor. Now, when you get hurt on the job, you typically have to see a doctor that's chosen by the insurance company or is on a list maintained by the insurance company that is overseeing that claim. But if before you got hurt, you have pre-designated, that is, pre-selected a doctor of your own choice, and you have to do that in writing and give it to your employer before you've been hurt, then you are able to, you're not restricted to the doctor that the insurance company chooses for you or tells you that you have to see, but rather you can go see the doctor that you have pre-designated. You do have to have a pre-standing relationship with that doctor. That is, you have to have seen that doctor or received treatment from that doctor at some point in the past in order for that pre-designation to be valid. And kind of a practical tip is you probably want to ask your doctor if he or she is willing to treat you if you got hurt on the job before you pre-designate them, because many what I call private physicians, that is, physicians that don't do workers' comp, choose not to treat workers' comp injuries or work injuries. So you probably want to have your doctor's permission before you pre-designate them so that you know that if you get hurt and can go see them, that they will actually see you and provide treatment. But you asked about percentages. In my experience, very few of my clients have done that. It's either because maybe they don't have a doctor to have that relationship and designate, or they simply don't know that that's their right. Rod may have a different experience. I think he tends to represent maybe more union workers in the Bay Area, whereas I'm in Sacramento, and I represent often a different client base. So I don't know, Rod, do you see that happening with your typical clients?
Surprisingly, Jason, no. We do see in San Francisco more union employees, and the unions are pretty good about reminding their members to pre-designate a doctor, but for whatever reason, folks tend not
they
to
don't
do it.
Do it.
They don't do it.
Well, that's a shame.
It is a
that's
shame.
A big mistake, is it not? Because if you submit your claim to your employer and you fill out the paperwork and you haven't pre-designated, then automatically you have to go to one of the doctors that's recommended by the workers' comp insurance company, is it not?
Correct. And it almost always starts with a clinic. And for minor injuries, these clinics can usually get the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
But the follow-up care there tends not to be good. The good news is a worker can opt out pretty quickly.
Really?
The employer maintains control for the first 30 days, but quite often if an injured worker asks for a different doctor, the insurance company has the right within that 30 days to pick the next doctor. Frequently, they'll let the worker choose a doctor, which brings us up to a topic of doctor networks. Most of these employers and insurance companies have networks of doctors, and the worker must choose within that network.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, if they contact the claims examiner, if they've looked at the network, pick a new doctor, the examiner will authorize that doctor for them. They can get out of that bad clinic.
What if you don't like? What if, for example, you get into the network and you're assigned to a particular doctor who you don't like, and you're saying, Rob, that if you complain, you can get someone else. Well, what if the next person you get, you don't like that doctor either?
You can change again.
Really?
And you can get second opinions.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So you can designate Dr. A,
mm-hmm.
be concerned about Dr. A's diagnosis, and request a second opinion from Dr. B,
mm-hmm.
still within the network.
Mm-hmm.
Or a worker can simply say, I want to change doctors.
Mm-hmm.
The law allows one automatic change where the worker doesn't even have to say why they're changing. After that, there are almost, and I stress almost, an unlimited number of changes an injured worker can make as long as they can demonstrate a valid reason. They've moved, their doctor's moved, they need a different specialty. So workers can change a couple. It happens. Bad luck, a doctor doesn't work out for a particular worker. They can change again.
Mm-hmm. Jason, I know you wanted to talk about this. There is apparently something that's going to become effective January 1st of 2018, which is as I understand it, it's a list of drugs formulary. Would you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So due to some legislation that was passed in the last couple of years, we are going to have a drug formulary in the workers' compensation system, and we're currently in what we call the rulemaking process. That is the administration, that the division of the California bureaucracy that oversees the workers' compensation system, has drafted some proposed rules and regulations that will kind of set out how the formulary is going to work. And as it stands right now, we believe it's going to be effective January 1st of 2018. And I say we believe because the rules are not final yet. There still could be changes. But as it stands right now, that's what it's looking like. And a drug formulary is nothing new. Most private health plans have a drug formulary. You may, you know, see that you have a preferred drug and a non-preferred drug, and your copay for the preferred drug is less, your copay for the non-preferred drug is more.
Uh-huh.
The workers' comp formulary doesn't deal with copays because the workers' comp system is supposed to be no cost for the worker. So whatever treatment the worker gets, be it a prescription or seeing a doctor or surgery or anything else, there is no copay. There's no deductible. There's supposed to be no out-of-pocket cost for the worker. But what this formulary is going to do is essentially set up a two-tiered system where certain drugs are designated as, oh gosh, I don't know if it's preferred or exempt. I think exempt is the current word they're using. They've been changing as the rules have gone on. So certain drugs are exempt, and exempt means they are exempt from any type of review. If the doctor prescribes it to the worker, that drug will be automatically authorized. And then there are a number of other drugs that will be labeled non-exempt, meaning that they have to go through the normal review process that exists in the workers' comp system. The challenge we have is not that a formulary in and of itself is bad. There's really nothing wrong with it if it's done right. Our concern as it stands right now is that, frankly, the number of drugs that will be exempt from the review process, it's a relatively narrow and small number of drugs,
yeah.
Whereas the vast majority of drugs that are currently being prescribed are going to remain on the non-exempt list, so they'll still be subject to the typical reviews and potential delays that currently exist in our system. And the other big concern we have is that as it stands right now, when those rules kick in January 1st, for any worker who got hurt before that date, they're going to have a roughly three-month transition period before the new formulary applies to them, meaning that that worker and his or her doctor only have a few months to figure out, do we need to look at changing your medications or submitting some sort of justification why you should stay on a medication that isn't on the exempt preferred list of drugs. By way of example, Texas, a state you may know of, implemented a formulary in the last few years, and as I understand it, they had a roughly two-year transition period for when the formulary went effective to when it applied to workers who had been hurt before that date. So it was a much longer period to kind of get used to how that process is going to work. And as it stands right now, we're very concerned about the short window that the administration is proposing to give to workers and their doctors.
If coming back to who your doctor may be, or if you, let's say you don't have a doctor, how significant is it if an injured worker, having gone through the paperwork of filing with the employer, being injured, and goes and sees and retains a workers' compensation attorney to represent him or her, how significant is it or how practical is it for the injured worker to say, do you have any doctor you can recommend to me, Rob?
That's extremely important. We were talking before we went on air that this would be a good time to make a plug for getting an attorney early if mm-hmm. someone thinks they need an attorney. Our fees are fixed, so the worker is going to pay roughly the same fee whether we represent them for a month or for a year.
How much is the percentage?
It's typically 15%.
1.5.
1.5. Mm-hmm. On rare occasions, a judge will suggest 18, or an attorney will request 18 for a very difficult mm-hmm. case. But that's mm-hmm. those are exceptions. That happens very rarely in my practice. But I honestly think that the most important work we do is sometimes within the first few weeks of the claim, getting the worker to the right doctor and making sure they understand the rights. And what a lot of workers don't realize is that when they file for a claim, there's a waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
And no benefits are provided until the insurance company accepts the claim, with one exception, medical treatment. They can get medical care even if the insurance company is still in their investigation.
Right now. In other words,
right now,
if you're injured today, supposedly I could get medical treatment tomorrow?
All you have to say is I'm injured, and they
really?
Must provide medical care.
That's good.
Up to $10,000.
That's wonderful.
If the claim is eventually denied, then all benefits stop.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of that is if an injured worker gets into a good attorney, a good doctor, maybe referred by a good attorney.
Maybe the doctor's also the attorney, huh?
We've got one in San Jose.
Okay.
that doctor can write a good report to get the claim off on the right foot.
Mm-hmm.
If the insurance company sees a report from the initial treating doctor that makes sense, that's coherent, that explains what's going on, explains why this should be accepted as an industrial injury, quite often the insurance company will. That might tip the balance in having them accept the claim. So it is important to get into a good doctor as early as possible.
And let me ask you this. The 15% you're talking about as the fee, unless it's a very, very significant, long-lasting, et cetera, case that would have a higher percentage, that 15% comes out of the award that the court will issue or whatever this, the settlement or whatever, however it ends up, is it not? It's not out of the pocket of the worker.
That is the case, and that's something that we might want to talk about in a little more detail next month.
Yeah,
next month
okay,
we'll be talking
good.
About settlement issues. But right. I think the important thing for someone who might be afraid to hire a lawyer.
Yeah, that's my point.
The injured worker pays nothing out of pocket.
Yeah.
Fees can come out of their benefit. So if we go out, if a particular benefit is disputed and through our efforts we get that benefit paid to the worker, a judge would award us a fee on that. If we don't get any benefits for our client, mm-hmm. they owe us no fee. And unlike other areas of law, there are no costs in workers' compensation. That's something that folks quite often don't understand mm-hmm. when they have a personal injury case. They pay legal fees. They also
well, yeah.
pay costs for
yes.
getting records. For
That's different than workers' comp.
We have none of those costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
right.
even
there,
if a claim—
There's no fee to file with our court. If there are costs associated with pursuing a claim, like getting a medical evaluation or getting some records, those costs are borne or paid for by the insurance company. So mm-hmm. the worker, neither the worker nor their attorney have to pay those costs. And the other thing I'll point out, you know, as Rob said, there's no— money that a worker has to pay directly to us, because again, it comes out of their ward. The initial consultation, so that is you decide you want to talk to a lawyer, you call a lawyer, you get an appointment, you go in and see the lawyer. Regardless of whether that lawyer wants to take your case or you want to hire that lawyer or not, there is no charge for that consultation. And if any lawyer out there is telling an injured worker that they have to pay him for the consultation, that's absolutely against the law.
I'm glad you pointed that out.
That's very good, yes.
And when I talk to folks that are still deciding on an attorney, they've maybe spoken to me, they want to speak to some other attorneys, I suggest they look for a certified specialist and look for an attorney that's a member of the California Applicants Attorneys Association, CAW. If an attorney meets both of those requirements, they're going to be experienced and they'll know how the fees work and the person will get good representation.
Let me give a couple of – I want to give CAW's website again, and it's – CAAA at CAAA.org. That's the website. That's correct. Am I right, Jason?
You are. And I will say on that website, we have a tool where you can search for attorneys. You can search by name. You can search by your zip code or by an address or a location or even whether the attorney is a specialist, whether they speak languages other than English. So there's a lot of criteria we can use so you can find a CAW member in your area. And for workers who may be listening, CAW represents right around 700 or so workers or attorneys that represent injured workers up and down the state from San Diego to Eureka and north and everywhere in between. So hopefully wherever a worker lives, they can find a CAW attorney in their neck of the woods.
That's terrific. And if you are also, if you're looking for a certified specialist in workers' comp, the California Board of Legal Specialization has a website. It has 11 specialties, and it has a website where you can go to that, find your county, and then plug in what specialty you want, whether it's workers' compensation or one of the other 11. And that website you might want to jot down for the future. I hope you don't need it. But for the future, you might want to have it, www.calbar, C-A-L-B-A-R, www.legalspecialist.ca.gov. Go to the upper left corner of your screen. You'll see Legal Specialist. Click that on. Then find your county, and you're going to be able to find who the legal specialists are in your particular county. What if, I know one of the things that I think, pardon me, Rob, go ahead.
I was just going to make one slight correction. The email address for CAW is caw@caw.org. To go access the website, it's simply caaa.org.
Oh, is it? Oh, well, thank you for correcting me.
And then you can go into the attorney search, find an attorney.
Ah.
Give that attorney a call, and I guarantee you, if they're not able to help, or if the geographic, if there's a distance problem, they'll find someone to help the worker.
So to get to the website, it's what again?
caaa.org.
Okay. All right.
And so, if someone calls me, the nice thing about being a member of this organization is we know a lot. We know the cream of the crop of attorneys in California. So if I know someone is up in the Davis area, I'm going to say, I may not be able to handle your claim, but you call Jason. He'll take care of you. I know attorneys all over the state, and we all do. We help each other out. So it's a great resource for workers, that and the bar website.
One of the things that I have seen recently, and Alice O'Sullivan, who was a certified, I don't know that Alice is still certified in workers' comp because she retired and went to Oregon to have a nice life. In any event, she keeps me apprised of what's going on, and she will send me the things that CAW is doing. And one of the things that's brought to my attention fairly recently is that workers' compensation attorneys represent, of course, non-documented workers. By that, people who are facing potential immigration problems. And they're representing these people in workers' comp cases. Now, one of the things that CAW has done, Jason, is to recommend that attorneys provide to their clients a letter that the client can give if someone, let's say, in law enforcement or whatever, wants to talk with them, the client has this letter to give to that person and has a right not to answer. Would you talk a little bit about that, Jason?
Yeah. So a worker is entitled to workers' compensation benefits regardless of their immigration status. The fact that someone may be an undocumented worker is not a bar to obtaining benefits. And in fact, we have a labor code provision that specifically excludes immigration status as a discoverable piece of information, meaning that the other side can't even ask the worker if he or she is documented or legally allowed to work in the country. That's simply off limits. I don't want to get overly political on your show, but in the current climate that we have in our country,
yes,
you might imagine that some of our undocumented clients and their families have had an increased level of concern about whether filing a claim or participating in a claim or even going to court is going to put them in jeopardy.
In other words, an invitation to ICE.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, I will say we have heard from some of our members, more in the South than in the North, but they've actually, some of our attorney members have come across ICE agents appearing at the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board hoping to encounter and potentially arrest and then deport undocumented injured workers, which, frankly, is just abhorrent.
Well, I agree with that. I certainly agree with that.
And I was wondering, Chuck, I was hoping you weren't going to ask me, you know, what percentage of my practice might be undocumented workers.
Yeah.
I don't know because I don't ask.
Yeah, good.
They don't, since the workers' comp system doesn't need to know and can't know, I don't ask.
That makes sense.
And
that
also, you brought up a good point. Anyone who is working for pay in California is entitled to workers' compensation benefits, and that includes folks that are working under the table, receiving cash at a construction site.
You mean they're cheating the government, but they could still do it?
Well, one wonders who the greater cheater is, the employer that's paying the cash or the poor person that's just trying to make a living.
Right,
but I represent
right.
people who maybe have worked at a restaurant and they've been getting cash under the table for years. I'll represent them. And it is also illegal for anybody to turn that person over to the IRS or the Franchise Tax Board, for example, for not paying taxes on those wages. They can't do it, so that worker is safe pursuing a workers' compensation claim. To threaten the injured worker by reporting them to the Franchise Tax Board is extortion.
Well, thank you very much for that. That's very important. There is something fairly new, Jason, I'd like you to both of you to talk about. It's the Return to Work Supplement. What is that, and it is fairly new, and what's the significance?
Right. So this is Jason. I'll start on that and let Rob fill in the blanks that I miss. There is currently, for workers who get hurt and are unable to return to their at-injury job, and if their employer doesn't offer them some sort of permanent modified position to come back and work for the company, workers are entitled to what we call a supplemental job displacement benefit, or we refer to it as a voucher. One, because that's a lot less words to say, but two, because the benefit is in fact delivered as a piece of paper called a voucher. It's money that is not paid directly to the worker, but instead can be used to redeem for payments for education, such as to a college or a trade school or things like that. And then for workers who were hurt on or after January 1st of 2013, so really anyone in the last 4.5 years, if they receive that voucher, and again, they'll get it in the mail, it's a physical piece of paper, they can go online to the Division of Workers' Compensation website, and I apologize, I don't have the website, and it would be cumbersome to give it out, but if anyone is sufficient with Google, they can find it. Or if they aren't sufficient to do that, they can go down to the local district office, that is the courts that oversee workers' compensation matters, and there are about 24 of those scattered throughout the state. And there they will find a computer and a kiosk that they can use. In any event, they can submit that voucher online and receive a payment from what is called the Return to Work Supplement Program, or the Return to Work Fund. And currently, that fund will pay a worker who has received a voucher a $5,000 check. You will get a live check in the mail from the state of California in approximately 30 days after you submit your voucher to the fund.
Jason,
money can be used either to supplement your schooling or for anything else that the worker may need.
We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. And what I want to do now, pardon me, everybody, we're doing this program live, and I'm going to give you our toll-free number if you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment. It's 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. For all of you who are not that familiar, we record the first half hour. It is then sent out to a number of stations in California, which air the first half hour next week. But we are doing this program live now on Wednesday evening, August 9th, and I invite you to call in with your questions, your comments, whatever it is that you would like to present to my guests. And they are Rob Wyman, a member of CAW. His office is in San Francisco, and Jason Marcus, president-elect of the California Applicants Attorneys Association, CAW. And I want to get that correct website back to you, incapcaaa.org. He's a partner in the Sacramento law firm of Marcus, Regalado, and Marcus. So feel comfortable, if you would, with your questions, your comments, whatever, to call in with your questions, your comments, your concerns. And frankly, whether you're a worker or an employer, I ask you to join us with your question, your comment, if you feel that it is something may be helpful to you and maybe others who are listening to the program. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services Program of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. And the point of this is, most of the counties in California have a bar association and a lawyer referral service. This is a wonderful service for you if you're worried, gee, I can't afford these big fees of attorneys. The whole point is you call the lawyer referral service, tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find an attorney who's experienced in the problem with the problem that you're having or that area of the law. They'll set up a half-an-hour consultation for you with the attorney, and with minor exception in the state of California, you'll pay something like $25 to $35. It's a great, great investment to kind of get you on the same wavelength with what's going on so that at least you know where to go next. So again, our toll-free number on this evening of the live program, August 9th, is 866-798-8255. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for...
Sure, you're on.
I'm a certified, a state-certified interpreter, medical interpreter, and since 2002. And I think it's really important for your listeners to know that injured workers who don't speak English are entitled to having a certified interpreter. However, there's a lot of ways that different parties use loopholes to not use certified interpreters, unfortunately. And some agencies, you know, they use uncertified interpreters. So it's very important, and I know that many applicants' attorneys are aware of this, and they do their best to use certified interpreters. However, there seems to be some problems because the insurance companies just are, they depend on the use of one or two agencies, sort of like preferred provider networks, like the same kind of preferred provider networks that they use for doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these agencies use some loopholes, and not necessarily do they use certified interpreters all the time. So,
Lisa,
it's really important that certified interpreters be used.
Lisa, let me ask you this. When you say certified, who's certifying the interpreters? What agency?
Well, first of all, medical legal interpreting, there is a certification that existed and was put forth by the California Personnel Services from the Department of the Civil Rights Department from Office of Civil Rights, and that test no longer exists. However, that certification is still valid
for
med legal evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a national certification, two national certifications that exist for healthcare interpreting, for a follow-up, and also for med legal medical evaluations. And, of course, there's the court-certified interpreter and the administrative hearing interpreter for specifically the legal realm. In many cases, some medical interpreters, when there is no legal court-certified interpreter or administrative hearing interpreter available, are qualified to do also legal if the judges deem them qualified. They are qualified because they've taken a test, and they have done the hard work of taking the test and having done the work over the years. They have
Let me then, Lisa, get some comments from my guests if there are any. And I thank you very much for calling and informing us about that. I certainly was not aware of that, although I am not a I have never been and am not a workers' compensation attorney. So if you turn your radio back on, maybe we can get some comments. Rob, do you have any comments?
Sure, Chuck.
In response to Lisa?
Yes, every worker is entitled to an interpreter if they need one. And if they have an attorney, the attorney is going to make sure they have a good certified interpreter.
Okay.
And that interpreter will accompany them to all doctor's appointments, physical therapy appointments, deposition if necessary, court hearings. We'll make sure that there's someone there to interpret for them.
See, that's very good.
And I see clients come in with cases that maybe get off on the wrong foot because they're not using an interpreter, they're not able to express their issues to the doctor. So we want to get the interpreter in there quickly, make sure that the doctor understands what's going on.
Well, that's very significant.
Yeah,
obviously. Jason, any comments on that?
No, exactly what Rob said.
Okay, very good. All right, Ann, welcome to your legal rights.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the pre-designated option. I had the experience not so long ago where I did want to pre-designate, and the employer told me the only way I could do that was if I submitted it on a special form, and it had to be their form. I had given them a letter with the doctor, and I asked the doctor, but they said it was only acceptable if it were if it was on their form.
On your employer's form?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you then do that?
I'm sorry.
Did you do that? Yes, I did do that. Okay.
But I'm in a job search right now, and I've got a couple of offers, and mm-hmm. you know, I know I'm going to be facing this possibly the same issue.
Mm-hmm. This is Rob. Every employer is required to have that form, and so a worker simply has to ask for it, and it will be given.
It's the pre-designation form.
Correct.
Okay. And obviously, Anne, when you get another position, you're going to have to ask for that form.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just so I make sure I understand, so don't give them anything. Ask them for the form first.
Correct. Ask them for the form and make sure it's a doctor that you have seen before. It has to be a doctor that you have established a relationship with.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay, Anne.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. All right, everybody, don't be bashful out there. Here's our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And please don't wait for another 15 minutes or so because we'll be gone. Rob?
Jason, I'm going to anticipate a question that
please.
Might come up. How difficult is it these days to get treatment authorized? In this first hour this week, we're really focusing on doctors and treatment. I get more calls about treatment authorization than anything else these days. What's your experience?
Well, you know, when it works, it works. It's the when it doesn't work that it becomes challenging. And the difficulty is that our process is so the process is difficult. It's reliant on forms, on technicalities, rather than there being a relationship where we kind of trust the doctor to do what's right for the injured worker. I feel like our system and the powers that be that have designed it have created a process where it's really like guilty until proven innocent, right? So a doctor has to submit his or her request for treatment on a specified form and in a specified manner, and that's all good and well, but you know, if you get a doctor that maybe doesn't do workers' comp all the time and just wants to prescribe treatment, if the doctor submits a report but doesn't submit that correct form, the adjuster can essentially ignore the request and say, I don't have to respond to the request until the doctor fills out the right form. And that, to me, misses the point. And so when I run into situations like that where we are not really talking about whether the treatment is medically necessary or reasonable, but did the doctor submit the right form in the right manner, you kind of, you know, get stuck down in the weeds, and it becomes a very frustrating process for the worker, right? Because the worker goes in and sees the doctor, and the doctor says, you really need to have this physical therapy. And then the worker waits 3.5 weeks before they get it. And all that does is delay the worker's recovery, put them in a bad mindset, and keep them out of work longer, and then nobody's happy.
And if the doctor does the job perfectly, Jason, I found that the treatment request can still go through utilization review. Now, an insurance adjuster has the right to simply authorize treatment, and there are a few out there who will look at the big picture and say, this seems reasonable, let's get this person treated and back to work. But it seems like more often than not, they just submit everything through review. And so there's an automatic delay. It's going to go through one stage of review by a company chosen by the insurance company. Now, if they say the treatment should be authorized, it's authorized. However, if that review company hired by the insurance company denies the treatment, it then goes to another level of review. So several weeks can go by. A worker's handed a prescription for some medication. They don't understand why 3 weeks have gone by and they still don't have their medicine.
Boy, that seems really terribly unfair.
It is. And I'll give you another example of how unfair it is since we've reached the rant phase of our talk. That second level of review that Rob referred to is something that we call independent medical review. And workers out there may have seen that name floating around on paperwork. Well, that came into being as part of a 2013 reform, so again, about 4.5 years ago. And as part of that rules, the law says that second review process, the independent medical review, shall be completed within 45 days. Now, I'm not that smart, but typically I know that the word shall means must. It's mandatory. Well, after this process came into place, we were finding that these IMR, independent medical reviews, weren't being done in 45 days, or even 60 days, or even 90 days. Sometimes they were taking 180 days, or 300 days to be done. All the while, the worker is waiting to hear if they're going to get that treatment or not. So some attorneys within CAW filed at court, filed their appeals, went up to the Court of Appeals and argued that, and ultimately we've been told that no, that word shall doesn't really mean shall. It's not mandatory. It's what they call a discretionary. So even if they don't meet that 45-day timeline, there's no remedy for the worker. Too bad.
What in a situation like that where the worker is not being treated through the workers' compensation system, Rob, what can the worker do, if anything, because the worker's hurting?
They have every right to go get that treatment elsewhere. Of course, the worst-case scenario is if they don't have insurance, they could pay out of pocket, but that's not realistic. Veterans can go use the Veterans Administration, and we're blessed in Northern California. They have fantastic veterans hospitals, so veterans can go get treatment there. Workers can use their private insurance. The private insurance must treat if the workers' compensation system is denied treatment. Now, the problem comes when the injured worker goes to his or her family physician. The family physician says, well, I don't think I can do this, or I don't understand it, I don't want to. I mean, that physician has a right to say no.
Yes.
We can't force them to provide treatment.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to talk to family doctors, and I'm sure Jason is too, and explain to them that, yes, it's legal, and the doctor isn't working through workers' comp. They're going to submit that treatment through the private insurance, or if it's a large HMO, are we allowed to say Kaiser on there? Kaiser, someone can go to Kaiser if they're a Kaiser member and try and seek treatment there. I found it's very important, if treatment's been denied, that the worker take a piece of paper, take the written letter that says the physical therapy's been denied, or if the claim's been denied, for example.
Yeah.
The claim's been denied, we're still fighting to get it accepted. They can take that denial letter to their doctor, and I think that helps get the doctor to understand that they can prescribe treatment. Now, the doctor also has to be in agreement with the treatment plan. The workers' comp doctor may recommend one medicine. The private doctor may think another medicine is better. That's their call. But I have quite a few clients who are getting a lot of their treatment, unfortunately, through their private insurance. It also means that they are responsible for the co-pays.
The client is.
The client is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
For those clients that can afford the co-pay, it's a good way to keep their claim moving forward, get them back to work sooner.
If this is a situation, for example, where the doctor's office, your personal doctor, has taken the position or has the practice that I do not do workers' compensation cases. So you've been injured, your claim through the Workers' Compensation Insurance Board or the insurance carrier has been denied, and you go to your doctor, but you do have your own medical insurance. Maybe you're with Kaiser, maybe you have Blue Shield, etc. And if the doctor says, hey, I'm sorry, you know, you've been my patient, but I don't do workers' comp cases, Rob, if you were informed of that, how would you deal with the doctor? How would you communicate with the doctor that, by the way, you can treat this patient and can charge Kaiser or Blue Shield or whatever it may be?
That's exactly what I do. I'll call the doctor. Doctors hate getting calls from lawyers, but I'll call the doctor and I'll explain that
Is it a love-hate relationship?
Well, they understand that workers' comp is the primary provider of treatment in these cases, and they worry that they're doing something illegal or they're somehow skirting the workers' compensation system. Workers can always get treatment anywhere. If they go outside the workers' compensation system, they're responsible for the payment through their insurance. That's why they're responsible for the co-payments. But they can treat elsewhere. There's nothing wrong with that. And again, especially if treatment's been denied, I've been relatively successful with those doctors that are on the fence, convincing them that it's okay, it's legal. They just want to make sure they're not doing something wrong.
Well, that was my point. If a doctor feels that, well, I can't do this, what you're trying to do is explain to the doctor, yes, you can do it. You're not really doing a workers' compensation case under workers' compensation insurance. You are doing it through Kaiser or Blue Shield or whatever the insurance carrier may be for your patient.
Another good reason to be with a doctor that's not in a clinic, a private practice doctor, preferably one that has a relationship with a workers' compensation attorney, is that those doctors, in addition to treating through the workers' compensation system, will often accept other forms of insurance.
I see.
So, for example, one of my clients couldn't get his knee surgery done through workers' compensation. That same workers' comp doctor is submitting the bill to Medicare.
Oh, I see.
Medicare will treat.
Very interesting.
Or if that doctor is a member of a other insurance company, a preferred provider with another mm-hmm. insurance company, mm-hmm. they'll put that treatment request through the other insurance company.
Any comments, Jason, on this?
I mean, I fully agree with everything Rob is saying. I have taken the initiative to call a physician or write a letter to a physician, a non-workers' comp physician, to let them know that the claim or treatment has been denied or that they have the right to treat the worker. Another thing that often comes up between my client and myself is they go, well, am I going to have to pay for this bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I go to Kaiser and then Kaiser provides it and then Kaiser finds out it's really workers' comp, am I going to have to pay? And the answer is no.
Mm.
Again, as Rob said, they may have to pay those copays and they may not be entitled to reimbursement for that. But as to the underlying bill itself, if a private or group health provider provides coverage that they believe should have been paid by the workers' compensation carrier, they have the right to file what is called a lien, which is a document to protect their financial interest in the workers' compensation claim. And what that lien does is it basically puts a flag in the file that says before this case is settled, before a judge can approve a settlement, we have to figure out what to do with this group health plan that's paid money, and they will have to work with the workers' compensation insurance carrier to work out some sort of reimbursement or otherwise resolve that, but the worker is not going to be stuck with that bill.
Okay, well, should we take another call? All right, Mike, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
What, Chuck, are you able to hear me?
I sure can.
The phone is better than I thought.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Go ahead.
It's a question about retaliation for filing a claim. I'm 7 years retired, so I may have missed something, but in 2009, as I was retiring, I injured myself. And in my industry, unionized trucking, the entire industry seemed to be beginning a policy of disciplining people who filed claims. Progressive discipline, as you all know. And the first step was a letter of warning, and it always said, this is for an unsafe work practice.
Uh-huh.
We're seeing a lot of that.
Oh, my. Is that in violation of the law?
It can be. Every case is a little bit different, but when we see a pattern of retaliation, I mean, employers are required to maintain a safe workplace, and if a worker is behaving, by the way, workers' compensation is a no-fault system.
Right.
So even
right.
if a worker is careless, causes their own injury, they're going to get benefits. And if a worker has done something careless, an employer has some right to discipline them in some way, mm-hmm. and that's acceptable. But what we've seen, as the caller said, is a pattern of one well-known employer was disciplining and suspending employees for not stretching before work.
For not stretching.
If they had stretched before work, they might not have had that back injury, which is absolutely
brother.
Ludicrous.
Oh, my.
and when we see that pattern, we do file a discrimination complaint against the employer. That goes through the workers' compensation system.
Really?
Most people know it as the 132A petition. That's the part of the labor code that says you can't retaliate against an injured worker. Also can't retaliate against a coworker.
Mm-hmm.
Coworkers who may be testifying on behalf of someone else
of the injured,
are protected.
Uh-huh.
That claim does have to be filed within 1 year of the retaliatory act, not 1 year from the date of injury, but 1 year from the retaliatory act. So if mm-hmm. someone is dismissed, discharged, penalized down the road long after the injury, as long as that petition is filed within a year of the act, the worker may receive some increased benefits.
You did not do this, Mike?
I retired instead, but I'm left with the curiosity of what my coworkers are still putting up with. Like I said, it was progressive discipline. The first thing was merely a letter. The second or third thing might have been time off without pay. That would seem to be material. But then we had a grievance system. So which way would that have gone?
Well, what I have found, this is Rob again, is that with the one employer that I see a lot, and I won't say who they are, but they're a very, very large employer, when we started filing, the union worked with us, and they would file a grievance. We would file this, as I've called it, the 132A petition, the discrimination petition, workers' compensation. What we were finding is the employer was reversing their position.
Oh, really?
They were rescinding the written warning. They were giving the worker back the pay from the suspension. I haven't had to take one of them to a hearing yet. And this company was doing this nationwide. The practice is dropping off because they are being challenged.
Good.
The union worked with me and made sure that every single time this happened, even if the injury was extremely minor, something that maybe didn't need an attorney, they'd still send them to me so that we could make sure we filed that claim and let the employer know we're not going to let this practice continue.
Did you, Mike, ever go to a workers' comp attorney to try to get some advice on what you might do?
Well, yes, I've been to attorneys, but never on the subject of the retaliation.
I see.
Like I said, I just retired.
Yeah, and you retired back in 2009.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling and bringing this up, because this has been a very valuable brief discussion on this. Take care. Thank you very much. We have a few more minutes, everybody, and again, we're still doing this program live, believe it or not, on Wednesday evening, August 9th. So if you'd like to call in, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Jason, well, we're waiting to see if anyone else would like to speak to you and Rob. What would you like to insert in this first segment that we're doing? The next segment will be on Wednesday evening, September 6th. But what would you like to include on this segment of your legal rights?
Well, I think the things that I would like to include are, one, if someone gets hurt and has questions about what to do or what their rights are or how they should proceed, you know, we talked about it earlier, I'd recommend reaching out to an attorney and again, preferably someone who is either or both a certified specialist in workers' compensation and a member of the California Applicants Attorneys Association, because that's going to mean you're going to get someone who is experienced in workers' comp and knows what they're doing, and again, there's no charge for that consultation. But not every case needs a lawyer. In fact, when things work right, folks like Rob and I often don't need to get involved, and sometimes that's even the best decision, because the person's getting their treatment and they're going to get back to work and life is fine, and that's great. You don't need a lawyer. You may not need a lawyer in a case like that. There's another resource, though, for people that don't have a lawyer. It's called the Information and Assistance Unit. It's part of the California Workers' Compensation Court System that I mentioned earlier. There are employees of the state. They're called Information and Assistance Officers, and their sole job is to assist unrepresented workers, that is, workers who don't have an attorney, with questions about their case. Now, they cannot give legal advice, but they can answer questions about forms that the worker may have received. There's all sorts of letters and notices that a worker receives throughout the life of the claim, and sometimes they say things like, you must act within 10 days, or you must fill out this form, or you must answer these questions, and it can be very intimidating for someone who is going through this for the first time. And so they can use that resource, either call them on the phone or go down to in person if they're near one of the district offices throughout the state, and talk to one of those information and assistance officers and maybe have their questions answered and understand more about what's going on in their claim.
But you're saying, besides being able to go to one of the local offices wherever you may be in California, you can also call your local office to actually speak on the phone with an information assistance officer?
That is correct.
See, that's terrific to know.
It's a terrific service. They're very helpful. They work with judges on unrepresented claims and help the worker understand the system. But as Jason said, they can't provide legal advice.
Yeah.
But they can be very helpful filling out forms and just understanding what's going on.
These are not lawyers, though, I presume.
They're not lawyers.
They're not. Rob, anything else you'd like to bring up?
Going back to the treatment issue, again, I think getting to the proper doctor early on in the claim is most important. And workers need to stand up for the rights, get out of these awful clinics, get into a private practice doctor. It's important to know that they can see more than one doctor. Mm-hmm. They have a primary treating doctor, and that doctor can refer them to as many specialists as are necessary. And getting that claim off on the right foot with a good doctor is probably the most important thing we can do.
Jason, let me come back to you for a moment. And we have a couple of minutes max left in the overall program. What do you do if let's say you're not doing well at all, and you're hoping that someone will help you? I mean, you talked about the information and assistance officers, but if someone is not sure of what he or she is doing, what would you suggest you do?
Well, probably at that point, they might want to reach out to a lawyer and see if they can schedule a consultation. From my own experience, when I meet with what I refer to as a new client, that is someone who I do not yet represent and am considering representing, you know, I take about an hour, give or take, usually, to sit down with them in person, look at the paperwork that they've brought in, get my head wrapped around what's going on in their claim, explain the basics of the system to them, you know, how the system works, what benefits they may be entitled to, and then kind of come up with a game plan about where their case needs to go. And, hopefully that when they leave my office, even if I'm not taking their case or they're not hiring me, my hope is that they leave my office with more information about what the system is, what the system isn't, and what's going on in their claim.
And very briefly, we have about 30 seconds left. If the injured person isn't sure whether or not he needs an attorney, in a few words, what would you say?
If treatment is being denied,
okay.
If they get a letter of denial,
you've said it. We have come to the end of the program. I didn't mean to cut you off, Jason.
That's
but,
fine.
But we uplink to the NPR satellite, and they get angry if I go over time. In any event, I want to thank you both very much. Great to have you both on the program. Jason Marcus, President-elect of California Applicants Attorneys Association, also referred to as CAW. And Robert Wyman, also a member of CAW. Jason has his office in Sacramento. Rob has his office in San Francisco. They're both specialists in workers' compensation law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, and, of course, very much involved with the California Applicants Attorneys Association. Thanks, both of you, very much. Great to have you on the program. Next time on Your Legal Rights, we'll discuss the rights of debtors both before and after filing for bankruptcy. My guest will be Leon Bayer, a specialist in federal bankruptcy law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McClain. This segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program for national distribution. Thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights, and I hope you join us next time on your public radio station, and especially for part 2 of Workers' Comp on September 6th. I'm Chuck Finney.